This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik. And today I have in the studio with me for the second part of our World Heart Day special, Dato' Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from Cardiac Vascular Central KL or CVS KL. Dato' Razali was here last week as well for the first part of World Heart Day, and he talked about atrial fibrillation and really narrowed in on the risk of stroke, especially if you are an older patient with atrial fibrillation. And he talked at length about how to manage that risk, especially with the use of anticoagulant medications. But today we want to look beyond stroke, because there are other issues for people living with atrial fibrillation as well. And one thing that Dato' Razali really talked repeatedly last week about was that more and more young people are being diagnosed with atrial fibrillation or AF today. And so what kind of treatment can young people look forward to not only reduce the risk of stroke down the line, but also improve quality of life, because these are adults at a point in their lives where they're working, they're starting families, lots of quality of life issues that we want to look at there. So Dr. Razali is going to walk us through the management for young people, and especially looking at the pros and cons of ablation as a treatment option. So if you have questions, please call us 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dato' Razali, as I said, last week you talked about seeing more younger patients today with AF compared to,
50 years ago?
Yeah, when you first started doing all of this. And, younger patients in their 30s and 40s.
Right.
They have a different profile, not only their age, but they usually have no other underlying medical conditions compared to the older patients. So how has that changed the way you approach treatment for AF in this younger demographic?
Right. So, thank you. That's a very important question. So I struggle this every day myself. When I was a medical student, and we're talking about eons ago, we used to be taught, and I believe some medical students are still being taught this very day, that atrial fibrillation is just a disease of aging. And that was true. Many, many years ago, we hardly see atrial fibrillation in those below 70. Mm. So the treatment for atrial fibrillation in elderly is different. The AFFIRM trial that was published 20 years ago now showed that it made no difference whether you control the rate or you maintain in sinus rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
But these were in elderly patients mainly. But over the last 5 years, and this is surprising, and I thought, It's not only that I'm seeing it, but I think all my colleagues all over the world, we are seeing an explosion. I mentioned we are seeing actually another pandemic. But this pandemic is not going to go away.
Mm.
COVID-19, inshallah, will subside when we reach enough people getting infected.
Or when we find a vaccine.
Mm. But atrial fibrillation, it has been shown in the US, in China, that it's going to explode. It has exploded. So, and what is more disturbing is that we used to think that not only is atrial fibrillation a disease of old people, but if you have comorbidities like heart failure, diabetes, hypertension, valve disease, all these are reasons for atrial fibrillation. But as I said, I'm seeing, again, this may be a bias because of referral bias, but I'm seeing disturbingly young patients with none of that.
Mm.
And, when I first started my practice in CVS KL, in the month of March 2018, I received 3 young patients. And it was so interesting. That March, I remember 2018 March very well, because these 3 patients, ranging between 40 to 55 years old, all had heart failure collapse, and was admitted to another hospital where, of course, the doctors were right in thinking that they had a massive heart attack because their heart function was so bad, and later found out that nothing, they had no coronary artery disease, they had no other medical problem except that they had atrial fibrillation that they did not know themselves. So one of them were actually doing a half marathon.
Right.
So after the half marathon, he actually nearly collapsed. So basically, no symptoms, but they were all running atrial fibrillation. therefore not treated, the heart rate was going so fast until it caused heart failure. And all three of them, in fact, all three of them not only had heart failure, but heart failure with multi-organ failure. They had, one of them had renal failure, one of them had liver failure. And so these patients, because they were young, finally we did catheter ablation. And I'm happy to say that all three of them are very well now. So subsequently to the March 2018, I thought that's a one-off thing. But in my practice, and now 2020, every day in my clinic, I will see at least a few young patients. When I say young, means they're below 65. Mm-hmm. And they have atrial fibrillation.
Every day?
Yes, every day. Most of my patients that I see now in CVSKL, 20 years or 30 years ago when I started electrophysiology, 90% of the cases I see in electrophysiology in Malaysia is young patients with SVT, supraventricular tachycardia. Mm. That's common. Mm. It seems that we have gotten rid of the SVT over the last 30 years. We've been ablating a lot of them. So now, what we are seeing now is a different category of arrhythmia patients. Mm. And I think my friends out there as well, both in government practice and in the private, are seeing more and more atrial fibrillation. I'm seeing a bit more atrial fibrillation because at CVSKL, we are the center for AF.
Mm. Is that typical progression for these younger groups of patients with AF, that they don't realize they have it and they only come in at, well, the point of almost sudden death, you know?
Correct. Yes. Yeah, so, you know, symptoms is a very, very important. It's like when you have chest pain, then it will, your heart is telling you to stop and go and see your doctor. But somebody without any chest pain carry on running the marathon and collapsing at the end. So similarly with atrial fibrillation, for many patients, actually, symptoms, it may not be there or it may be so subtle. Sometimes they say, oh, I climb upstairs after the second flight. I feel a bit, my heart go a bit fast and I feel a bit breathless. Mm. It's just, I'm not fit, doctor. That's what they thought. Yeah. So now, I think one of the reasons why we see more and more patients, younger patients with AF, is a lot of these, you know, like home devices, their watches.
Wearables.
Like, yeah, that's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. They're wearables in which they can pick up your heart rate. And then they notice their heart rate is very fast. And sometimes their blood pressure machine will say BP is unrecordable or you have some abnormalities. And these are the ones that trigger them to go and seek treatment. And then we found out they actually have atrial fibrillation.
All right. So when you are seeing more younger patients, what is it that you want them to achieve, when you start managing their condition?
A cure from atrial fibrillation. So, you know, I always tell patients and I tell fellow doctors, we are not born with atrial fibrillation. So when you get atrial fibrillation, especially when you're young, the best is to get rid of it, nip it in the bud, get rid of it before it grow roots. So essentially, and it's literally like growing roots, because we will see changes in the left atrium in which caused purely by atrial fibrillation. So electrical arrhythmias can actually lead to histopathological structural changes.
Irreversible?
And this, once it sets in, scar tissue is irreversible. Mm. And that is why we notice that when we do AF ablation, when we treat them when they are very early onset, that the chances of a cure, long-term cure, is much higher than when we allow patients to be in atrial fibrillation for years and years. Because then there will be changes in their heart, which causes a scar tissue, something like a heart attack, which these scar tissues will not be able to be reversed, and this will perpetuate atrial fibrillation. And even after ablation, the chances of it coming back is higher than when it is in this new early onset.
What exactly does a cure mean? Like you said, it doesn't occur again, but
right.
Like, how long are we talking about?
Right. So when we see a patient with atrial fibrillation, and the first thing we do is to assess for stroke. And that's what we talked about last week. That's why the first thing I always talk about and is stroke prevention. So if the patient has been adequately protected by giving anticoagulants, or if he's young, he does not have any, his risk for stroke is so small, we then focus on the arrhythmia itself. Now, so the arrhythmia itself, if it is causing a lot of symptoms, so even though for some patients it may not lead to heart failure, it may not lead to any symptoms, but sometimes the quality of life. They say, I used to be able to run half marathon. I used to be able to walk 5 kilometers. Now I can't. He's 40 years old. Do you want him to be a 70 years old before his time? Mm. So you want to give him back his quality of life, give him back his exercise performance. And that is done by either you give him a drug which can suppress atrial fibrillation. So not just allow the atrial fibrillation to run wild and just control the rate, but give him something that can prevent atrial fibrillation. But drugs, as you know, is not a cure. So nowadays, when we first started ablating atrial fibrillation 20 years ago, we were very selective because at that time, all of us in the world actually just started doing AF ablation. We do not know. We don't have our experience. We don't have enough numbers to justify, advising patients to undergo AF ablation very early. So we only offer it after a patient has failed 3 or 4 medications and have so much symptoms that they can't live with these symptoms. Mm. Nowadays, if I see a young patient, I will inform him about this, what we just discussed. If we get it early, then it's a higher chance of curing it. And if you're young, you don't have any other abnormalities and your echo shows that your heart function and structures and size is normal, then the high chance that you'll be cured, which means that once the ablation that we do for you, you will not get any more AF until maybe when you are 75 or 80, because then that's aging atrial fibrillation. That's different.
All right. And there you want to look at stroke prevention.
Yes, of course.
As your main.
So at least we can give you 20, 30 years of good quality of life without being disturbed by atrial fibrillation.
Okay. We'll go into ablation very shortly. But you mentioned drugs.
Yes.
Would these still be offered as a first line
yes,
therapy?
Correct. So for all the guidelines at the moment would suggest that we offer at least a trial of one anti-arrhythmic agents. Now, and I deal with anti-arrhythmic agents, and as far as I'm concerned, they're all poisonous because they can lead to a condition called torsade de Pointes. Torsade de Pointes is when you take an anti-arrhythmic agent to treat something relatively benign. If you interact and somebody else give him a drug that he should not take, and this causes interaction with the anti-arrhythmic agent and can cause a condition where the QT interval prolongs and the patient can actually get a cardiac arrest. So when we give a patient this anti-arrhythmic agent to suppress atrial fibrillation, we're actually giving him a poison because we hope that he doesn't get all these side effects. One of them is actually, although quite rare, is torsade de Pointes. They actually can collapse because of cardiac arrest. So we will give them a list of drugs. And I actually tell my patient, once I give you this medicine, if any doctor wants to give you any other medicine, please ask him to contact me.
Right.
Because I want to be sure that you're not giving him something that can potentially cause harm to him.
What kinds of medications?
Luckily, it's not something that he can buy off the counter, over the counter. These are usually the antidepressants, major antidepressants, antipsychotics, and there's one antibiotics. Erythromycin. Sometimes family practitioners, they like to give erythromycin. Erythromycin cannot be given in patient who takes anti-arrhythmic agents for atrial fibrillation. It can cause torsade de Pointes. If the patient gets diarrhea or vomiting, his potassium comes down. That can also potentiate long QT in a patient with anti-arrhythmic. It can cause torsade de Pointes.
Right.
Yeah, I had recently a patient who was taking something. His potassium went down. He had a cardiac arrest. Luckily, he was in the hospital.
My goodness.
And it was due to the drug.
And I assume there is more than one type of antiarrhythmic medication,
yes,
though.
Yes.
Is it the same?
All of them. Oh. All antiarrhythmic agent.
All right.
Because they act on the sodium channel and the potassium channel. All of them have got the potential for prolonging the QT interval in the ECG. And this can lead to a condition called torsade de Pointes. It is actually a French word. Mm. Malaysian call it torsade de Pointes. But it's torsade de Pointes. So it's actually polymorphic ventricular tachycardia.
All right. Well, I mean, not to frighten everyone who's on, potentially on antiarrhythmics.
Well, thousands
now
of patients are on this drug. So, but I just,
but
and this
caution
is important message. Yeah. When you are on this drug, make sure that you know that there is a potential bad interaction.
All right.
So your doctor should advise you carefully and give you a list of drugs at least to avoid before he prescribes you this.
All right. And let's go for a quick break now. When we come back, let's talk about ablation. And we really want to unpack, you know, what a patient would undergo when he chooses, to go with the route of ablation for atrial fibrillation. What are the outcomes to be expected? I know you've talked about a cure, Dr. Razali, but, you know, there are also concerns about if it doesn't work out first time, is there a need for a repeat procedure? Things like that, we're going to discuss with Datuk Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from CVS KL. We are discussing ablation for atrial fibrillation today. Please call us if you have any questions, 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiaoyik. In the studio with me, Datuk Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from Cardiac Vascular Central KL or CVS KL. Datuk Razali has been described as the electrician when it comes to dealing with heart issues. And last week we talked about sort of the basics of atrial fibrillation, trying to understand more about this condition and not why we're seeing it in younger patients. We still don't really understand why, but the fact is it is being diagnosed more in younger patients now in their early adulthood. In this second part of our World Heart Day special, we are zooming in on using ablation as a treatment option to deal with atrial fibrillation. Dr. Razali has said many times it's potentially a long-term cure, so I want to find out what that means. If you have any questions, our lines are open, 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Before we get to ablation, just very quickly, Dr. Razali, you talked about the use of medications, antiarrhythmic medications. That's one option that patients can go with. There are very, very serious concerns about contraindications with certain medications that could be prescribed by other doctors, like antidepressants, antipsychotics, even erythromycin, a type of antibiotic. So those
And grapefruit.
Okay. Is this to do with the potassium?
Yes. No. Grapefruit has got enzyme which blocks the pathway in the liver, which then prolongs the bioavailability of the antiarrhythmic agents.
I see.
So luckily in Malaysia, we don't like grapefruits. It's not grape, it's grapefruit, the one that, you know.
The bitter one.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. That's a public service announcement right there. When you do have patients on antiarrhythmic medications, what are the challenges that they face with that regime of treatment?
Right. So first of all, we must make sure that they are not contraindicated. So patients who are taking a certain group of drugs like the class 1C agent, flecainide and propafenone, we must make sure that they don't have heart failure or structural heart disease. This was shown in the CAST study published 30, 40 years ago. But once the patient has got structural heart, post heart attack or heart failure, then they only can take Amiodarone. And for those of you who know Amiodarone, if you take it for long term, you have a lot of long-term side effects. Like it can cause corneal deposits, damage your thyroid, lungs, liver, skin. So, so it's not something that you want to give patients for lifelong. So all these medications essentially, I think, and we're not even talking about compliance. You give a 40-year-old guy with atrial fibrillation drugs, do you think he's going to take it for the rest of his life? Mm. He's probably going to take it for 1 year or 2 years, and probably after that he'll stop.
That's your experience?
Yes.
All right.
Nobody's going to take drugs. I mean, you and I don't think, even for us, doctors are worse. You ask him to take antibiotic for 1 week, after 3 days, no fever, he stops antibiotics.
Okay, this is not a public service announcement. Don't listen to Dr. Razali on that. So then, are you saying that you would introduce ablation right up front?
No. But if it's a young patient, I'm more inclined. So we're talking about two groups of patients. If the patient is above 65, 70, then I would be more conservative. Because if he's very well, I can just give him a rate controlling agent and stroke prevention. But if he's very young patient and no other abnormalities, why do I want to subject him to medications with the potential of torsade de pointe? I would discuss with him very early on the pros and cons of early catheter ablation, because of course any procedure will have risk. So I would actually sit down with the patient, sometimes 30 to 45 minutes to 1 hour, to go through with him all the possible side effects. What people don't realize it, there are 10 times more people undergoing coronary angiogram and angioplasty than there's AF ablation, maybe 20 times more. But people go for angiogram, angioplasty like nothing. But that is a much riskier procedure than an AF ablation.
Okay. You want to walk us through what is ablation? What actually happens there?
Yeah. So in patients with atrial fibrillation, it was discovered in 1997, published in New England Journal of Medicine by a group of investigators led by this brilliant guy called Michel Hezeguet in Bordeaux, France, that the atrial fibrillation, about 85% of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, the short circuits, as it is, it's at the pulmonary veins. Mm-hmm. The pulmonary veins is, there are about four or five pulmonary veins in the human heart, which essentially brings oxygenated blood from the lungs back to the left atrium. So it is not the vein that is causing the AF, but the muscular sleeve, which follows the vein outside, which encapsulates the vein externally, which is the one causing the atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm. So when we first found that out in 1997, one of the first technique of ablation was we ablated inside the vein to get rid of the focus. Mm. But we learned very early on that that's actually terrible. It caused damage to the primary vein. So right. We have within 1 year, moved our technique to outside the primary vein.
All right.
So essentially, AF ablation is to electrically isolate all the electrical impulses that is causing atrial fibrillation by ablating, or nowadays we can do cryo. So the two energy sources is radio frequency or cryo ablation, freezing or heating of the pulmonary vein ostium, which is the mouth of the pulmonary vein, to disconnect the external electrical impulses. So once you dissociate the pulmonary veins where the seat of AF is, the atrial fibrillation, the heart itself is protected and it will not fibrillate anymore.
Okay. And what you're trying to do with ablation is scar the tissue, am I right?
Yeah, I mean, you kill the cells essentially without damaging the veins.
Okay. So,
that's the challenge.
All right. And would there be several points along this muscular sleeve that you said?
The whole circumference. So imagine a pipe. You have to go the whole circumference of that pipe. One, if you are able to be successful in 99% of the circumference of the pipe, 1% of that segment reconnects, boom, AF comes back. And that's the reason why AF comes back in about 10 to 15%.
Okay.
Reconnection of the pulmonary vein.
It sounds like a really, really complex and you know, requires a lot of fine expertise to do ablation. You know, can you walk us through actually, you know, what a patient will be undergoing?
Right. So the patient, first of all, after he's been counseled and all that, he will be told that the procedure will be done under general anesthesia. So the patient's, as far as he's concerned, is just he's asleep, he's comfortable. The first thing we do is we put in a transesophageal probe down his esophagus to make sure there's no blood clot. So one of the risks of atrial fibrillation ablation is stroke. So we protect the patient by making sure he continues taking his blood thinner, except he skips one morning. And then we will do a transesophageal echo, make sure there's no blood clot in his heart before we start the procedure. And throughout the whole procedure, we will give him heparin, which is unfractionated heparin, to prevent any clot formation on the catheters.
Okay.
And then we will map the heart. So as I said, we can do this either by mapping the heart and doing radio frequency energy, or we do cryo balloon technique. For patients that are undergoing cryoballoon ablation. So essentially, when we map the heart, we identify where are the pulmonary veins, where is the ostium, where is the antrum, where are the important structures like the mitral valve, where is the left atrial appendage and all that, by very accurate, dense 3D map. And then we plan our route. We plan where the lines of ablation is to be. And then we have a lot of tools now that can tell me exactly how much I'm pushing against the heart. So many years ago, when we do ablation, I only have the feel of my hand that I'm not pushing too much. But now there's a pressure transducer at the tip of the ablating catheter.
Mm-hmm.
So that if I'm just lightly touching the heart, it's not going to be effective. If I'm pushing the heart, so it registers more than 30 grams. So we will be able to know how much we are touching the heart so that it's just nice, just like Goldilocks, just nice. Not too little pressure, not too much pressure. So we can monitor that. We can monitor how much power we use. We can monitor how much the impedance drop. We can monitor the changes in the electrogram. So all these factors, plus the, you know, like the 3D machines now is so accurate. It's like, it has evolved over the last 20 years. It's so accurate that it is a real anatomy that we are facing. We can see all the undulating, all the ridges. And with all the new techniques, and of course, at the end of the day, is the operator. You have to be very, very experienced and have to do this very, very frequently to be able to reduce the complications. Because at the end of the day, this is a very technically challenging procedure, and the complications include perforation. You can tear the heart, you can cause stroke, and you can cause injury to the esophagus.
All right. Who should do an ablation?
So essentially, it's mainly done by electrophysiologists.
Like yourself?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, when I first started in IJN, there were only a few of us, like two or three in the country. But I'm happy to note down that at least we have about 15. Mm-hmm. And we even have our own society called the Malaysian Heart Rhythm Society, under the banner, of course, the National Heart Association of Malaysia, and very active. We do a lot of these activities, and there are a lot of up-and-coming doctors who are very interested, because it's not like, basically, you have more electrophysiologists, it creates a lot of interest amongst the young doctors, and we do encourage a lot of the young fellows, a lot of young cardiologists in training, do electrophysiology rather than the usual angioplasty.
Mm. So, I'm going to stay away from that topic. But you know, you keep talking about a cure. If you can nip it in the bud,
yes.
You know, and earlier also you mentioned, you know, a younger patient with AF, say he's in his 40s, he becomes like a 70-year-old when he has AF. You
yes.
know, he can't
yes.
Walk his usual distance, can't climb stairs, things like that.
Right.
Would successful ablation revert him to
yes.
pre-AF condition?
Of course. You have no AF, no symptoms. The trick is to maintain that sinus rhythm. So the thorn in the side of AF ablation has always been the recurrence rate.
Mm.
When we first
what
started,
is the rate?
Yeah, so when we first started doing it 20 years ago, it's like as high as 40 to 50%. So essentially, one out of every two patients would have an AF recurrence within the first 3 months, for example. So it's like he's back to square one. Now, after 20 years of experience, we have improved that number to about 80, 85%. Maybe if we are lucky, it's about 90%. What does it mean? Now, 90% doesn't mean it's a cure. 90% means that of that 90%, a majority of them, of that 90%, they have no more AF without any medication.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best result. I always tell my patient, group number one, you want to be in group number one, and I want you to be in group number one, which means after the ablation, you don't need those antiarrhythmic agents. But amongst those who have an ablation, one procedure, the patient has recurrences. And the very medication before, which did not work, they were taking the same medicine, but previously the patient said, this doctor, it did not work last time. But now after the ablation, it's as if we cut off the, let's say a six-cylinder car. I remove five cylinders, now you only one cylinder left. I can nip that cylinder out. Mm-hmm. I can cut off that cylinder easily by giving you the antiarrhythmic agent. So if you combine those patients who are completely cured plus those who are now asymptomatic, but needs to be on medication, is about 85 to 90%. That leaves us with 10% of the patient who is back to square one. So the patient will say, now I feel exactly the same as if you did not do an ablation. These are the patients that we recommend for a second repeat operation.
Okay, all right. Let's go for a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about, you know, what to expect in a repeat operation then. What are the outcomes after that, right?
Mm.
And also, you say you spend a lot of time with patients, talking to them about ablation.
Yes.
I'd like to hear about what are some of their concerns and how do you walk them through that.
Yeah.
I'm speaking to Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from CVS KL, Cardiac Vascular Central KL. We're discussing the procedure called ablation for atrial fibrillation. If you have questions, call 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik, and in the studio with me today, Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from Cardiac Vascular Central KL or CVS KL. This is the second part of our World Heart Day special. We're focusing a lot on atrial fibrillation, which Dr. Razali has called the new pandemic, the next pandemic. It's really the prevalence is increasing. It's increasing among younger people. Not only is the risk of stroke something to for us to keep in mind. But other issues, like quality of life issues for one, caused by the symptoms, but also leading to heart failure and other kinds of problems as well. And on that note, we do have a question here from Robert, who's asking, what is the mortality rate for ablation? So earlier we went into a procedure called ablation to treat atrial fibrillation, and that is trying to interrupt or destroy the cells causing atrial fibrillation.
Yes, I mean interrupting by destroying the cells that which cause AF.
Yes. And so you have already addressed the fact that there are risks. Any procedure would have risks. Maybe we can talk about Robert's question first about the mortality rate for this procedure.
Although, the risks that I mentioned includes stroke, cardiac perforation, and esophageal injury, they by themselves are actually quite low. In my last 20 years of doing AF ablation, I can only remember one patient that had a stroke, and that was, I think, the heparinization was not well looked at. Only one out of the last 20 years. I've had several perforations, which means the heart perforate, and that was the days before this pressure transducers and the first generation of the 3D machine. All those have improved because we have better 3D system and pressure transducers. And although, you know, mortality is always something that we don't want to, and thank God I have not had any mortality. If you look at all the data in the world, the mortality rate for AF ablation is like less than 1%. We don't talk about mortality. It's not a very dangerous procedure in a sense. And the risk that I discuss about perforation, they're all like 1% or even less. Mm-hmm. So in general, the patient is like it's not a daycare procedure. Some centers in the world, daycare procedure. They come in the morning, do AF ablation and go home in the evening. But for us in Malaysia, we actually admit them. So we rather, after the ablation, I observe them overnight just to make sure there's no bleeding from the puncture site.
All right.
So it's just like a one night or two night stay in the hospital.
What happens when there's perforation and how do you manage that?
Most of the time, the perforation is from a needle. So usually it will stop by itself. So we just need to remove the blood by doing a technique called pericardiocentesis. We poke a needle, long needle outside, draw the blood, reverse the heparin, and pray and hope that the hole seals by itself. Very occasionally when the tamponade or the bleeding is caused by a tear, then this will not work and we have to ask our friendly cardiac surgeon to open up the chest and stitch.
Okay. So even if you say these risks are low,
yes.
At the end of the day, it's still an invasive procedure.
Correct.
Why put patients through an invasive procedure instead of the more conservative
Correct.
Way with medications?
Hence why I take 30 to 45 minutes, because that's the exact question. So, and you'd be surprised, for patients who suffer from atrial fibrillation, you tell them all these risks, they will just say, doctor, can you do it now or tomorrow? Because we cannot understand until we have atrial fibrillation. They actually suffer. They actually feel very bad whenever they have AF. So even if the AF lasts for 1 hour, but the symptoms, the tightness, the lethargy can last longer than that. It's like you go for a run in the morning on Sunday morning. Let's say you go for a 10-kilometer run. That 10-kilometer is maybe two hours, but you feel very tired even after that, isn't it? Because your body was basically in hammering itself. So similarly with AF. You may have AF for 2-3 hours, but the whole day is out for you.
Okay, but what if I am not as active? 10-kilometer runs
sure.
are not in my schedule.
Yeah.
I lead a more sedate lifestyle. Right. Is it still as problematic?
I just had a patient just now, before I came here. He's a young patient. And he told me, every time he has AF, he goes for a meeting. And he's like businessman. He goes for a meeting. He said he can't even listen to what the guys are talking about. He just said he closed the meeting and went home.
Mm.
Because he was in AF.
It is that bad.
It's that bad. He cannot concentrate and he feels lousy. He says, I just don't have the mood. I don't even want to hear what the other guy is talking to me. So when a patient has AF and he's very symptomatic, you tell them, you say, I can do this procedure. There's a chance for a cure, but there's a small risk. So, and sometimes my own patient tells me, doctor, you go for dental extraction, so you got risk. Anything got risk, isn't it?
All right. And you talked about a rate of about 10% where correct me if I'm wrong, where patients may need a repeat procedure.
Correct.
All right. So at what point would the AF typically come back again?
So after the ablation, we have this 3 month period. We call it a blanking period, which means that this, even if the patient has AF, within the first 3 months, we reassure the patient it may not be a recurrence. It's part of healing. But if the patient recurs after 3 months, that is a true recurrence. And then it's, again, depends on whether the patient belongs to category two or three, which means, can I control this with medication? So if the patient says sometimes, the group of patients who are very symptomatic and fail medications. Mm-hmm. So for this group of patients, you've done ablation. Unfortunately, he has a recurrence. But the very same medication that failed previously now becomes effective. And the patient feels, I'm happy to take this medication for now. But from my experience, after 1 or 2 years, the patient will say, you know, can we do it again? Because he has forgotten about, you know, whatever he has done. Sometimes after a procedure, they say, hey, I'm going to go through that again. But after 2-3 years, he says, you know, like, can we explore, you know, I think nowadays you, the machines are better, you are better, your experience is more. Can we do more? Can you guarantee me a better outcome? I say, of course. I mean, of course, 2-3 years down the road, of course, all of us will get more and more experience. The machines get better, the catheters get better. And of course, inshallah, we will be able to improve our success rate.
But with a patient who is undergoing it a second time, what is their success rate there?
So every time you go for a procedure, it increases.
I see.
It increases, but it will never, I mean, there will be a point of time when, you know, like, let's say you do 5 times, the chances are you'll be cured. Now,
five times?
You know, like, okay, I mean, this is, I went to one of the top centers in the world because I wanted to see for myself, these guys are the best, the very best in the world. And when I went there to visit, the particular doctor was doing a patient for the 5th time. And for the 5th time, and I was partially relieved that I'm not that bad. Because if you see the best in the world, even they sometimes have to do like 3-4 times because it's just the very nature of this AF. If we can cure them, fine. And that's why all of us in the world, all the EP guys who do AF ablation, realize one thing. Catch them when they are early phase. Mm. Because once you refer to me when they already have 10, 20 years of AF, I probably end up doing 3 or 4 times of AF ablation. But if you do it when they are young, they only have AF less than a year, then the chances are they are the ones who will be cured.
All right. Is there anyone for whom a repeat ablation would not be possible at all?
Repeat ablation will not be possible for those who refuse, who are not interested.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
So sometimes elderly patients, they still have AF. So, and they say, I don't want ablation anymore. So we give them alternative. Alternative, maybe AV node ablation plus a pacemaker, for example, just to relieve the symptoms.
Okay. How would you balance that then? I know that you still prefer ablation because of its outcomes, but how would you balance the need for ablation with perhaps the other options if the patient is feeling a bit wary about ablation?
Right. So, I mean, so we give all these options to the patient, but if the patient is young, and I said, you don't want to live your life with a pacemaker because the pacemaker doesn't last forever. The pacemaker needs to be changed every 10 years. But if you're 80 years old, then if you are symptomatic and ablation is out of the question, both the doctor and the patient agrees that maybe ablation is out of the question, then if you are very symptomatic, then a simple strategy, although that strategy is not a perfect strategy because it's basically sweeping the problem under the carpet, isn't it? AF is still there. Risk for stroke is still there. But I just make you forget your heart doesn't feel the AF anymore. Your heartbeat now is regulated by the pacemaker. But it's not suitable for young patient. Mm. Because the young patient is still being exposed to AF. The young patient is still being exposed to stroke risk. And he has to live with a pacemaker, which has to be changed every 10 years. And the leads may need to be changed after 20, 30 years. Mm. And the extraction of the lead is far more complicated and riskier than putting in a new lead.
All right. We have a question here. I just want to make sure that I get the, I understand this correctly. He's asking, what is the influence of a missed heartbeat and the start of AF?
Right. So the missed heartbeat is what we call extrasystole. And that is the classic trigger. So AF doesn't come out by itself. it needs a trigger. It's just like when you start your car in the morning. Mm-hmm. So that's the trigger. The ectopic, the missed beat or extra systole, your heart goes boop, 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 boop. Boop, 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 boop. So when a patient, before his atrial fibrillation, he will feel these misbeats. He will feel these extra systoles.
Okay. Yeah. And so that
That is a trigger. So not all patients with extra systole in the atrium leads to atrial fibrillation.
Okay.
There are some patients who just have extra systole but no atrial fibrillation.
Okay. So for this listener who's asking, let me just put it out for you. What... should he be concerned then?
Oh, so he has misbeat and he has AF.
All right. So we're talking about two different things here.
No, I mean, so it's the same thing. So as I said, the misbeat is the trigger for the AF.
Okay.
So when we go after the AF, after we also go after the triggers.
Okay, I see. All right. We have another question from Daniel here. Are there plans to increase the number of electrophysiologists?
That's
in
what
Asia?
I've been doing for the last 30 years.
Yes. And as if you said, you know, you have seen a small increase at least in the numbers. He's also asking, will blood markers help in the diagnosis?
For atrial fibrillation, I mean, if you have atrial fibrillation, some of the blood markers may be increased, but they are not, they're just as a consequence. The proBNP may be increased, the troponins may be increased, but it's not a diagnosis of AF. AF diagnosis is from an ECG.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, just to wrap up, how do you what do you foresee for us to improve the recognition and treatment of AF? Because if, like you say, it's so widespread, but really not as well recognized as it should be, how do we become more sensitized to it? You know, at all levels as well. For those of us who can use wearables, I guess that's a start. But you know, at the primary care level, things like that. You know, what can we do to address this?
Yeah, so it's a difficult question because it opens up a Pandora box. Because one of the things that we are now discussing is that subclinical AF, patients who have AF because they wear wearables. We don't know. We don't have data. The data that we have are for patients with symptomatic AF.
Mm-hmm.
So for patients with symptoms of palpitations, I ask them to wear a wearable so that I can detect what their palpitations are. But for patients who then come to see me and says, my Apple Watch tells me I have AF,
mm-hmm.
that's more difficult to treat because we really do not have any data. What do we do with this patient? Are they at the same risk as patients with symptoms? Do they need treatment? So this is being worked out. So this is now the current, a lot of research is being done. It's basically a whole new topic of subclinical atrial fibrillation.
So is
even
it,
the definition.
Is it more dangerous then? I mean, are you
we
over?
We don't know. Mm. We don't know. Because the definition, for example, if you have a pacemaker and your pacemaker is not implanted for AF, it's implanted because you have slow heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And then we pick up AF because your pacemaker is so good, it tells me since the last visit, I have picked up and noted, the pacemaker will tell me, that this patient has got AF three times.
Right.
And so the question was, previously, our definition of atrial fibrillation that was picked up by device is at least 6 minutes. We say if it's more than 6 minutes, then the patient has a risk for stroke. And we now recommend if you have CHAD VASC score of two or more to put on, to take oral anticoagulants. But the recent data shows that maybe 6 minutes is maybe more than 24 hours. So there's still not enough information. So for patients who are silent clinical AF that is picked up by wearables, picked up by the pacemakers, we still have a lot to learn.
Okay, but what should they do then? A lot of people are using wearables now.
Correct. So if I see and because wearables, sometimes they say it's AF, but it's not AF.
Mm.
So we have to first of all make sure that it is really AF. And then we will investigate. And then we will look at your risk factor. Let's say you say, I have no symptoms. This AF is only lasts for a few seconds, a few minutes. No other risk factors to suggest you have... I just monitor.
Okay.
Yeah, don't do anything.
All right. Just very quickly, we have a question from May who's asking whether a leak in the heart valve could cause AF.
Yes. All the things that I talked about was basically non-valvular AF. Non-valvular. Because the valvular AF is the different kettle of fish. We're seeing less and less. Previously, when we, Malaysia, when we were very poor, we see a lot of rheumatic valve disease, mitral valve disease. Mm-hmm, we see a lot of AF related to the valve.
Yeah.
Nowadays, most of Malaysians are very rich, so they don't get rheumatic fever. But they get valve problems, like aortic problem when they are older. And this group of patients also get atrial fibrillation anyway.
Mm.
So valvular atrial fibrillation, given the context of rheumatic fever, is totally different. The risk for stroke is no longer five times, it's 15 times.
times.
I see.
So valvular AF is, especially mitral stenosis, very tight mitral valve, that one is very, very bad. And unfortunately, only warfarin works for those group of patients.
Ah, yes. You were talking a little bit about warfarin last week. Another question here. A listener who's 70 has AF, regularly experiences an irregular heartbeat, but he wants to know why he doesn't feel bad.
Yeah, so as we discussed, a lot of my patients also, they don't feel the symptoms. So we call it asymptomatic silent AF.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are 70, then even though you don't feel bad, I think you should be treated for stroke prevention.
Yeah.
Because anybody above 65, by the age themselves, they should be on blood thinner.
All right. Do you have a final message for this two-parter that we've had you on to talk about atrial fibrillation?
Yeah, first of all, thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity. I enjoy coming here once a year. And we talk about,
you can come more frequently, Dr. Razali.
So I hope over the last two sessions, and for those of you who don't catch this, maybe you can catch the podcast.
Indeed.
Though I think it has, I think from my own experience, it has helped a lot of patients. Patients hear this podcast on AF and they come and seek treatment. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity, and I hope that the message that we mentioned today will be able to benefit those who hear, not only the patients, but also the doctors.
All right. So as Dr. Razali mentioned, you can download the podcast. You can search for atrial fibrillation, or you can also search for World Heart Day to find other conversations that we've had about heart conditions. I've been speaking to Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from CVS KL. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.